The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters today on a beautiful December 15th in Urbana, Illinois. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we're going to be talking about journalism. And our guest is one of the really interesting and most controversial professors of journalism in the United States today and a working journalist, Robert Jensen, a longtime friend, I must add, of myself. I've known for a good decade. Before becoming a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, Bob Jensen was a journalist, a working journalist, and he is still one. He writes widely for a variety of alternative and mainstream popular media. His opinion and analytic pieces on such subjects as foreign policy, politics, and race have appeared in papers around the country. He's also involved in a number of activist groups working against U.S. military domination of the rest of the world. Most recently, Jensen is the author of a new book, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. He also has a new pamphlet, Citizens of the Empire, Thoughts on Patriotism, Dissent, and Hope, and that can be downloaded actually off the internet, and I'll give you more information about that later in the show. Bob Jensen, are you there?
Sure am, Bob.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's a real treat to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And I'd just like to start off, if I can, the big story of the past week or so, maybe 10 days in the news media, has concerned the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott of Mississippi. And I know you've been following this case. And one of the things I've seen on the margin, not necessarily in the margins, but is that this is a classic case of the liberal media going after a politician just because they said something that was politically incorrect and sort of beating up on this guy on some sort of minor thing he says to take attention away from the fact that the policies he espouses are very popular. I wonder if you could give your assessment of the Trent Lott episode, because you've been writing about race and race matters quite a bit, as well as, the more importantly for this show, the press coverage of it, what we learn about press coverage from the Trent Lott incident.
Well, we're on a long-distance phone call here, but the sarcasm managed to get through the telephone line there. I think there's a lot to learn about American society and about journalism from this. The first thing is that it took the press some number of days to really make this story as important as it should be. And I think there's something important in that, which is that the major media, the New York Times, Washington Post, the people who really set the agenda for the national news, it's a great indication of just how wired into the powerful people they are and how they have to be careful about how they cross those people. Now, Trent Lott, Senate Majority Leader, you know, a real power broker on Capitol Hill, which means he's got control of, among other things, information. And reporters are very hesitant to cross people in that context. And I think the delays that mainstream journalism encountered here before really putting the story front and center tells us something about that relationship, that insider coziness in Washington between reporters. I suspect there were not all that many reporters eager to put Lott on the spot and be the ones to get out front on this. So I think what we saw was a number of activist groups were really onto this before the mainstream media, groups like Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which, you know, put out an alert long before the news media was highlighting this.
Yeah. Now, is this a new thing for Trent Lott? I mean, it strikes me that one of the more important aspects of it, and the reason why it has finally become a story, is that Trent Lott has a career of making comments that basically are quite similar to this, which suggests this is not just the guy had a couple martinis too many and sort of blew a gasket, but rather he actually believes this.
Well, I think that's the only logical conclusion one can reach from the history. It's finally come out both in the press, but again, first in, from these more activist-oriented groups, that he'd said something virtually identical, you know, during the Reagan campaign in 1980. He's made other comments that really don't leave a lot of room for interpretation. And I think that's what the media, to some degree, is uncomfortable with, because I think we should tell it like it is. Trent Lott is a racist. And
you know, Bob, for the sake of our listeners who might not be familiar with this story, I should have started by saying exactly what it is he said a couple weeks ago.
And that's important to go back to, too, because the way in which the segregationist past of this country is being treated is interesting. But, of course, at a 100th birthday party for Strom Thurmond, the retiring senator, what Lott said was that he was remembering Strom Thurmond's 1948 presidential campaign on the Dixiecrat tickets. It was a breakaway Democratic Southern white segregationist faction of the Democratic Party. And it wasn't, you know, it's good to remember, it wasn't until 1948 that the Democrats actually began to take a stand for civil rights. And Strom Thurmond was their standard bearer in the racist segregationist South. And he did run for president. And what Lott said during this birthday party was, you know, he was proud that his state, Mississippi, had voted for Strom Thurmond. And that's an interesting little bit of history. 92% of Mississippi voted for an openly racist segregationist candidate. And he said if the rest of the country had followed suit with Mississippi, we wouldn't have all these problems we had over all these years. Now, you know, Lott's got an explanation that he really didn't mean, you know, we'd still be a racist segregationist culture and that'd be good. It was all these other things that Strom Thurmond stood for. But, of course, the lie of that is Strom Thurmond didn't stand for anything except segregation in 1948. That was the entire platform, basically, on which they ran. And I think, you know, the American public, I think, still has trouble understanding and coming to terms with the fact that that kind of really rank racist segregationist philosophy was with us, you know, well into the 50s and 60s, and I think for some people is still with us. And I don't think journalists are very comfortable in calling Trent Lott a racist, and I think that's partly where the delay came from, is not knowing how to handle this.
Now, you know, when someone like Jesse Jackson is seen in the same community as Louis Farrakhan, immediately Bill O'Reilly and the O'Reilly Report goes into overdrive talking about, you know, what a scandal this is and how they have to really examine his behavior and things like this. I mean, was the conservative talk radio and the television commentator pundit crowd, have they been teeing off on Lott? Were they pushing this story along? Do you have any sense of what their role has been?
Well, I think, you know, I haven't surveyed all of it, but my sense is that they're, you know, saying, yes, Trent made, you know, even some of the Republican leadership is kind of, there's a standard line now, which is Trent Lott, you know, was intemperate in his remarks, but we shouldn't conclude from them that he's a racist and, you know, we need to move on and the past is the past. And, you know, that's sort of the way the conventional wisdom works. When the past is unpleasant to have to deal with, then we say the past is the past. But in other situations, we dredge up the past when it can be used to bludgeon our opponents. And, of course, you know, you make the point we could assess this by asking how would these commentators and pundits react if it had been, you know, let's say a black candidate or a black politician or a dissident type voice who had, for instance, you know, you made the point Jesse Jackson meeting with Farrakhan. Well, of course, Trent Lott had also been buddying up with these fairly openly racist groups in the South, the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a, you know, the new name for what were once called the white councils in the South. Well, that's been going on in Lott's career for years. And, you know, all of these in the other situation with a dissident or minority voice would be grounds for great condemnation. But that's how the powerful work. They try to, you know, sort of slide past these uncomfortable realities and say, well, that's all in the past.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are open. We're accepting calls. This is a live show. The phone number here at WILL is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Bob Jensen is a journalist and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas and specializes in political coverage, especially of U.S. Foreign policy and international affairs, which we're going to spend a lot of time on today. But first, we really want to sort of talk a little bit more about the Trent Lott episode. Bob, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. And of course, Trent Lott is now also serving to some degree as literally as a scapegoat for the racism of the Republican Party. You know, the Republicans came to power nationally in the post-World War II era by riding white racism in the South. That's long been understood, and the strategy is clear. And, of course, George Bush and the current regime is trying to sort of paper that over. They want to continue that strategy, but they don't want it to be so obvious. So in that sense, Trent Lott, who the president apparently never much liked personally anyway, likely is going to have to fall on the sword. He may not go willingly, but it may be that Karl Rove will figure out a way to make all this work. And then Trent Lott serves another, you know, useful function for the Bush administration, which is to demonize a kind of overt racism. But I've been thinking ever since this story broke that in some sense the white supremacy built into the George Bush presidency is a far more sort of insidious and important aspect of race relations in the United States today. What I mean by that is George Bush is sort of the walking, talking embodiment of what we might call white privilege. If you imagine anyone who wasn't a white, upper, middle class, Christian, heterosexual, who had the career of George Bush, right, a failure in every business endeavor he attempted until he was bailed out by money from friends of his father, right? He never had a successful business enterprise in his entire career. You know, he got into the Texas National Guard during Vietnam and at one point literally went AWOL. He was, by his own admission, pretty much a drunkard up until the time he was 40. You know, he then bursts onto the political scene and wins the governorship of Texas with virtually no experience and nothing to his credit. Now, imagine a black man or a woman or anyone who didn't have George Bush's profile, trying to make a political career with that kind of record. I mean, it's laughable. The person wouldn't even get out of the block. So in a sense, what we should remember is that the kind of Trent Lott racism is still with us, and it's important to highlight it and combat it. But even more insidious is the way in which the entire system is built on white privilege, and people like George Bush, who may or may not, you know, hold the same kind of overtly racist beliefs as Trent Lott, benefit from that. The whole system is structured to benefit people like George Bush. And in some sense, I think George Bush is the scarier sort of face of race relations in the United States than Trent Lott. At least Trent Lott you can see, you can identify, and you can condemn. Bush is a much harder sort of target in this sense.
It's funny you should mention that. Or interesting, because Bob Herbert, the columnist in the New York Times just last week, had a column basically saying the same thing and arguing, therefore, that Trent Lott should remain in the Senate, that he shouldn't be made a scapegoat because he actually represents most aggressively the actual politics of the Republican Party. Let's go to the phone lines now. We do have a caller waiting to talk to Bob Jensen. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on the point you made that, you know, the reason the press delayed on this issue was because of the people of power. Yeah, during the Clinton years, who he himself seemed pretty powerful, they didn't seem to delay much at all with the Monica Lewinsky scandal going on. So, you know, does people of power only refer to Republican power, or is something else going on there?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I've been thinking through that, because the Clinton scandals were a real feeding frenzy. And I think there was something, maybe it's psychological, but the Clintons presented an interesting target. Of course, the Clintons were sort of softened up for a long time by right-wing forces that sort of demonized them and made them easy targets in a way. The other thing I think is relevant here is that in the last couple of years, especially after 9/11, the sense of the consolidation of power in Washington, the way in which the Republican regime has really run roughshod politically, I suspect has added to that sense of fear that journalists might have. I don't want to have any of these comments I'm making indicate that somehow I think Bill Clinton, you know, was a better president, or that I'm, you know, supporting the Clinton administration. But I do think the Bush administration has worked in a particularly effective way to shut down dissent. Now, a lot of this has to do with post 9/11, but just the way in which they've controlled the political scene in Washington, and strategically, it's been brilliant. I mean, one has to concede they're extremely effective at what they do. But the sense I get is that reporters are much more concerned about towing the line in a town now where that power is used, in a sense, kind of on the surface, quite ruthlessly to punish people.
Okay, we're talking to Bob Jensen today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have phone lines open. The number is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We're going to turn to discussion in the coming moments of U.S. international politics and prospective war in Iraq and perhaps elsewhere. First, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi. This is a little complicated, but I think it's pertinent to what you were just talking about, the control of, well, I guess spin control it was called. I was looking through the Mayberry Machiavelli article in Esquire about Karl Rove, and it reminded me that, well, it doesn't include the story that I think I heard on this program when Mark Crispin Miller was on, about how Karl Rove purposely leaked false information, supposedly, to this fellow that wrote Fortunate Son, that I think documents the inebriated and AWOL career of George Bush in the early days in Texas. And I just wanted, maybe if you could reprise that and talk a little bit about Rove and the crew and how they're managing, despite a fair number of gaffes like a Kissinger appointment and things like that, to still be able to spin things to their credit, at least apparently it looks that way. I have something else if there's time.
Well, do you want? Why don't you give both questions if you like, caller, and we'll just answer them sequentially.
Okay. Well, the other thing is that you mentioned the FAIR alert about Lott. I'm also thinking of the FAIR alert about this Live from Baghdad story that manages to use the babies in the thrown out of the incubator story to discredit CNN as being manipulated by the Iraqis, when it was actually a blatant manipulation by Hill and Knowlton, a story that we have also heard here on these airwaves, but doesn't have any legs in the regular media. How can they get away? And I just think it's just so outrageous. And it's also maybe for another show how entertainment media is being used to in an ideological way with all of the JAGs and I've lost track how many CIA sort of stories there are on the network entertainment media these days. And I'll hang up and listen, and thanks for your time.
Well, I don't think I need a job after these great questions we're getting from our callers.
Do you
want to start in with the first part, George W. Bush?
Yeah, let's go back to Bush. I mean, I think the success the Bush administration has had at controlling the political landscape is partly about their skill. I mean, those of us in Texas saw this a sort of a preview of this when Bush was governor. I mean, he was really an ineffective governor. It's a weak governor state here in Texas. The governors don't tend to have a lot of power. And Bush, you know, was clearly preparing to run for president. He avoided every controversial issue there was. He managed to get bills killed in the legislature so he wouldn't have to, you know, face the decision of signing things that were controversial. And Rove, you know, did a brilliant job of basically taking a guy who, quite frankly, in the popular sort of street language, might have just been called a loser most of his life, right? And turn him into this popular politician. So we saw this happen, and again, strategically, they're very, very skilled at what they do. But of course, the other thing is the bump that the Bush administration got came with 9/11 and the wave of patriotism and the very successful exploitation of that by the Bush administration. So I think if it had not been for 9/11, we might see a very different landscape, and the Bush administration might not be getting away with what they get away with.
Can I interject one thing on that, though, Bob? I mean, look at 9/11, though. I mean, imagine if Bill Clinton had been president or Al Gore. And imagine if they hadn't caught bin Laden after 14 or 15 months. I mean, what do you think, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and that whole crowd would be doing right now?
I think it would be the sort of relentless questioning of, you know, the wimp factor. How come we haven't been stronger? How come we haven't, you know, been more aggressive? I think you're right. There would be a bit of that going on. But I also think that it's hard to predict. I mean, 9/11 could have protected a Gore administration in the same way it's kind of protected a Bush administration. Some of this stuff plays out in somewhat hard to predict ways. Depends on the contingencies, but it's clear that, you know, the Bush administration has manipulated the 9/11 tragedy to their own advantage politically. I think that's, you know, without question been going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the thing I want to get back to, though, is that once journalism, and I don't want to suggest there's been some golden age of journalism when this wasn't the case, but once journalists decide that their most important sources are inside the government and inside the corporations and inside these powerful institutions, they become very much trapped by that. And I remember listening to John Pilger recently, who said, you know, the sort of secret to his success, this is the Australian journalist now in Britain, is he simply doesn't care about access to powerful people. He doesn't base his work on access to powerful people, and that frees him up to pursue stories wherever they might take him. Well, if you commit to that sort of insider access, then you're completely captured by them. And then, you know, to answer another of the question's callers, then things that, you know, might even invert reality can become conventional wisdom very easily if they're repeated enough. I remember, you know, the small scale of journalism at which I worked as a reporter, you know, covering city politics in various places. You know, there becomes, it's this notion of an echo chamber. If the powerful people say it enough and the reporters report it enough, you know, 2 + 2 can become 5 in the mainstream media. And the reference to the HBO Baghdad CNN story really is one of those cases. And
why don't you give a little, just explain that in a couple sentences for listeners who might be not familiar with it.
Well, the Gulf War, of course, and the driving the American population in 1990 and 91 into accepting the Gulf War was really one of the great PR masterpieces of modern history. And there were a lot of false stories floated, a lot of obfuscation from the Bush administration. We could talk about any number of them. But the one which has attracted a lot of attention is the construction of a story that Iraqi soldiers went into a Kuwaiti hospital and cruelly threw babies on the cold concrete floor to take the incubators out. This was a story, as the caller mentioned, that was concocted by a PR firm working for the Kuwaiti government. It was the subject of testimony in front of Congress by a tearful young woman who claimed to have seen this. Turned out she was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S., hadn't even been in the country at that point. But as the caller pointed out, in sort of a perverse inversion of reality, the HBO movie, Live from Baghdad, recreated this in a way that made it appear CNN was a tool of the Iraqis by reporting that there was some question about the incubator story. I mean, the whole thing is just kind of a joke. But again, it's that even though that this is well documented, it's been written about in books and articles, as long as the sort of echo chamber of the dominant media don't pick it up, then, you know, again, 2 + 2 can become 5 in this country.
You know, we've got a bank of callers I want to get to, and I'm glad they're being so patient, but why don't you just take a comment or two, if you would, Bob, about the caller's last sort of quick reference or question concerning the role of entertainment media as having political messages in them.
Yes, and you know, entertainment media always have a politics. I mean, that's clear. If you look at most popular entertainment, it's like one long running ad for consumer capitalism, right? I mean, almost every show, you know, sort of glorifies upper middle class life and consumption and fancy houses and that sort of thing. So, of course, we should recognize that any entertainment, any act of literature, any art has a politics to it. What's distinct, I think, about the modern or the contemporary situation is the degree to which all of this is being injected right up front with, you know, no subtlety at all, often with the direct cooperation of, you know, in this case, we might talk about the military. So, for instance, VH1, this is probably the example I find the most humorous, VH1, the music video channel, right? You think of music, pop music, rock music, as being connected to the counterculture, the anti-war movement during the Vietnam days. Well, you know, again, in a way in which our culture has been completely captured by these institutions, very powerful institutions, VH1 had been running something called military diaries, which was basically they gave camcorders to soldiers, and it's kind of a running ad for, you know, the U.S. military. Well, this kind of stuff happens all the time, as the caller noted, stories that kind of glorify the CIA. You know, I can't even count the number of shows, movies that have had FBI agents as heroes, you know, in the last 10 years or so. Well, this is just one more way in which the powerful institutions are really colonizing the entire culture. You know, art is one place for dissident expression. And if the media giants that now control the, you know, almost all the programming in this country have locked in a kind of art, if you want to call what's on TV art, that really is completely captured by these other institutions, I think, you know, the way in which the whole culture suffers is fairly evident.
We're talking to Bob Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas, today on Media Matters. Bob Jensen is the author of the new book, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, a book I read and I strongly recommend to those of you interested in journalism. We've got a full bank of callers. We're going to get to all of you. Thank you all for being patient. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi. I have a question, and I'll just ask it, and I'll be happy to listen to your answer. I have an idea that Jesse Helms was every bit the racist that Trent Lott has recently shown himself to be, but why don't mainstream media reporters talk about this? It's kind of hard to find that information. And I'd also like to know why don't the journalists report on someone like Jesse Helms' overall voting record, because since Trent Lott's comments came out, we're hearing a lot about his voting record. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Jesse Helms.
Well, again, I think one thing to remember is that once journalists become part of a certain class of people, it becomes very hard, and I think we all recognize this from our own experience, it's very hard to sort of call members of our own little subgroup on our sins and our flaws. And, you know, there was a time when journalists were outside those sort of circles of power. I mean, you know very well from your own work, Bob, that journalists were once it was kind of a working class occupation. Well, as it's become more and more of a white collar profession in certain ways, and as the people who occupy those top slots in journalism see themselves as really, you know, of the same class as people like Trent Lott and Jesse Helms, they go to the same parties, they run in the same circles. I think it becomes very hard, or at least much harder, for folks like that to then turn and tell it like it is, in a sense, because they have these sort of shared class identities. And if you add on to it the earlier point about the importance of access and how powerful people control access to information and how journalists are often very scared of running afoul of that power, I think what you have is it's not a conspiracy where they get up in the morning and say, how can we protect Jesse Helms, who again was, you know, kind of an overt racist. I don't even think it's, you know, very subtle. Well, that's the way that systems like this work. I mean, most any system one works in, you can see this operating. I mean, I've been in university life now for about 15 years, and I certainly see it all over the place. People who are just hesitant to turn to someone who's a member of their kind of class and say, well, you know, it sounds like you just said something extremely racist. I see people covering for each other in that kind of way in the university all over the place. It's maybe, I don't know, partly human nature, but it's certainly evident in these powerful circles.
You know, I'm reminded, Bob, of the great, even legendary journalist I.S. Stone, who from the 1940s until the 1970s was probably one of the leading critical journalists out of Washington, even legendary, as I said. Mm-hmm. And Stone's working operation was not to have any contact with official sources because he said it would corrupt his ability to basically call it as he saw it. He worked strictly in libraries with documents.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's so crucial. And again, we can see that in all sorts of enterprises. The way in which, you know, decent people, hardworking people, people with, you know, professional commitments and values can slowly be co-opted is readily evident. And it's not because, you know, people are evil or corrupt by nature. It's just that's the way systems work. You know, slowly mm-hmm. you become part of it, and it's very hard to resist. I mean, here at the University of Texas, I kind of try to stay outside of the system to the degree I can, not out of some sense of purity or something, but because I know my own weaknesses, and I'm very afraid of being sort of sucked into that. It's very seductive. It's very attractive. And all of a sudden, you wake up one day, and you're part of it. And then it becomes very hard to question it.
We're talking to Bob Jensen, and we just go to the phone lines again. Cell phone, line 3, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Yes, thank you, Professor. I have a question to ask you, and I just want to make a comment first that my opinion as an independent voter is that Trent Lott should resign his position, and if he really wants to see the best for the party and the country, he would resign. But I've noticed that there's a great deal of Trent Lott bashing right now, and I'd be curious about the professor's comment regarding probably the biggest racist that's a member of the Congress, Senator Robert Byrd, who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and advocated more than Trent Lott. He took an active participation in every anti-civil vote right he could possibly cast. Why, if Trent Lott steps down, shouldn't Robert Byrd step down as a demonstrated racist and bigot?
All right. Thank you very much, caller. Bob Jensen, should Robert Byrd also be called to the carpet?
Well, you know, I think here you have to look at individual cases. there are a lot of people who, I think, in honesty and with integrity, repudiate past beliefs and mistakes. You know, I think of Hugo Black, the Supreme Court Justice, who also had belonged to the Klan as a young man.
From Alabama.
Right, in the racist South. But I think someone like Hugo Black really did come to repudiate that, not just in, you know, rhetoric, but in his life and in his work. And I think, you know, none of us are you know, perfect, and I can think of some things I've said and done in my own past that I would hope I can overcome. The question is really, is the sort of the call for the request for forgiveness from someone like Trent Lott backed up with action? And on Trent Lott's case, I think we can see that it's not, that in fact the pattern is quite clear in his political life, that he has never, in a sense, repented. I mean, he's still appealing to the same instincts in the voters, you know, that he's got down in Mississippi. Now, the Byrd case, I must confess, I don't know a lot about the sort of track record of Byrd on these matters. He's mostly known in West Virginia for bringing home huge numbers of federal grants. I was just in West Virginia speaking, and Robert Byrd is kind of a legend there, mostly because every public works program in the state seems to somehow be attached to him. And I think that's the question I would ask about Robert Byrd. Is there in his life and his work evidence that he's repudiated that past? If there is, then I think it's perfectly acceptable to go forward. But another point that relates to something you brought up, Bob, earlier, is the way in which this works is if you're in power and you've got this kind of history, it can be shaken off quickly, and all is expected is that you'll, you know, apologize. But I think when we see others, for instance, I think of people who have a, you know, past association with the Communist Party, you know, that kind of trails you forever, because people from dissident positions don't just get to stand up and say, oh, I'm sorry, and everything's, you know, okay. That's the way power works in this country, and I think that's what we're seeing work with Trent Lott at this point.
We're talking to Bob Jensen today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you would like to get a weekly email from us here at Media Matters, we will gladly send you one. And in that email, we will have information about our upcoming guest, our past guest, information I can link to their writings if you want to learn more about them. For example, in our forthcoming email that we'll send out, we will have a link to Bob Jensen's new pamphlet, Citizens of the Empire, Thoughts on Patriotism, Dissent, and Hope, which is available at no charge on the Internet. And I'd read the address, except it's about 375 characters. But if you just send an email to our producer, Ben Scott, at dbscott@uiuc.edu, Ben will hook you up and get you on our weekly list. We just send out one email. There's nothing commercial. And it'll give you comprehensive updates on our show, who the guests will be, and links to what they've done. Next week, for example, our guest on Media Matters will be a taped interview I did with Gene Kilborn, the noted critic of advertising, and especially of gender roles in advertising, when she was in town a few weeks ago. In 2 weeks from today, our guest will be David Lindorf, the expert on civil liberties, who will talk about what has been happening to our individual rights and liberties in this country in the past year during this war on terrorism. Those are our next two guests on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines if we can, and we're going to go to our toll-free number. Chicago, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi, thanks for another fine show. Mr. Jensen, I appreciated that figure of speech that you used, colonizing the culture. I think that happens with media consolidation as well as the rest of the corporations. They get this much power, and they could actually be using it for the what they might define as the public good, and instead they just consolidate more power and use it for access. I think Michael Moore, in his movie Bowling for Columbine, made the point when he contrasted U.S. news reports with the Canadian news reports. He said they're not concerned with ratings. They're not concerned with commercial interests. They report what they think the people should know that day. I wanted to ask about economic and war coverage by our reporters and the matter of access. A few years ago, during the 80s, when U.S. policy in Central America was such a huge concern, This was in between the coverage of Grenada and the coverage of Panama invasion by the U.S. James Warren of the Chicago Tribune wrote a column about the decrying the establishment of a press pool by which the media themselves agreed to be limited in their coverage and to be selected by the Pentagon to cover war activity. And Warren thought this was a terrible move. Why shouldn't we encourage, or how can we encourage the media to demand that in covering economic policy, they don't go to the Secretary of the Treasury, they go to people like Barbara Ehrenreich, who's lived and written about it, or people who work in our economy or don't work, and in covering war, instead of going to the Pentagon, we need to cover the carnage. Why don't they cover the international observers, the peace workers who are over there and can report what's really happening on the ground? Don't we deserve that?
All right. Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, another question with lots of different avenues we could go down. First of all, on the Canadian media, I was just up in Canada giving a talk, and unfortunately the reports one hears up there is the Canadian media is more and more following the American model. So apparently things in Canada aren't quite as idyllic as we might want to think. And, of course, on questions of the effect of media consolidation and such things, I think, you know, Bob, you've done some of the major work on that, and I'll defer to you on that. On the Gulf War coverage, the military control, I think there's a couple of important points to make. One is, yes, the United States government, the Department of Defense, has got extremely skilled at how to limit and control access and how to reward reporters who play the game with access and punish those who don't. And we saw that first in Grenada, in Panama, and kind of perfected in the Gulf War. And it's clear they're continuing to perfect that system, and access in the coming war on Iraq is probably going to be, you know, even more tightly controlled with new innovations. So there was a school, literally, that the Defense Department was running for reporters the past few months for those reporters who want to be, as they call it, embedded in a unit. Well, now that may sound like that's good. The Defense Department's now giving reporters more access. They're going to let them out in the field. But, of course, they're not going to let them out in the field to cover the war, you know, the theaters of battle the way reporters would want to. What they're going to do is embed them in these units with the hope that the stories they send back will be kind of human interest stories. What's it like for the average, the average soldier in the field? That's a beautiful example of the sort of skill of the Defense Department. Now, there's one other point I want to make, that it's true the Defense Department does limit reporters' access, but I don't think we should let the commercial media off the hook. If you look at the coverage of the Gulf War, yes, the reporters were bottled up in Saudi Arabia and not let out, but there's a whole lot of other ways to cover a war. For instance, you can go to the borders of Iraq and talk to the refugees streaming out, which the, you know, non-American media did a lot of. You can cover the political context, the diplomatic maneuverings, with depth and subtlety and sophistication. The American news media did virtually none of that. So while I think I have a lot of sympathy for the reporters in the way in which they were controlled by the Defense Department, there's a lot of other failings of the American news media during wartime that are not about Defense Department control. They're essentially about ideology and about the routines of journalism, one of which, as the caller pointed out, is about this almost slavish devotion to official sources. And it's a long story about why that happened and how that's developed. But basically, it's a very cheap way to report the news, is to simply show up at the State Department briefing and take the news of the day. It's very difficult to seek out alternative sources, to find, you know, people who have knowledge and expertise. And a lot of it has to do simply with the sort of structure of newsrooms and routines. But I think it's a very complex story about why coverage of something like the Gulf War was so bad, and why, quite frankly, I don't have much in the way of hopes for commercial news media coverage of this coming war in Iraq. Certainly, coverage of the war in Afghanistan left a lot to be desired in these arenas as well.
We're talking to Bob Jensen, the journalist and journalism professor from the University of Texas and the author of the new book, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. We've got a full bank of callers. Let's get back to the lines. Line 2, Eureka, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Thank you very much. You are a breath of fresh air, Mr. Jensen, and I think we're getting a lot of things here we have not gotten gotten even on National Public Radio. My question would be, could you give a little bit more detail into, I believe it's the 18-month gap in our heroic, illustrious, gung-ho war President George Bush during the time he was in the National Guard during the Vietnam War?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, and I frankly can't do all of the details from memory. But the basic story has been well documented. George Bush, you know, was of draft age and during the Vietnam War and easily could have been, you know, shipped out. Like many children of the privileged and the powerful in that era, he secured a slot in the Texas National Guard, which was a guarantee you wouldn't end up in Vietnam. He did train as a fighter pilot with a very undistinguished record from all accounts, and then apparently never even, you know, finished out his entire term, went off to work on a political campaign out of state, and there's a lot of documentation that basically he was AWOL. That what's clear is that if a you know, run-of-the-mill soldier without powerful connections had done the same kind of thing, they would have been, you know, called on the carpet. But because George Bush, you know, comes from the Bush family, the people sort of turn a blind eye, and he goes merrily along. Now, what's interesting is what we learn about the way society works from that incident. What's also interesting is what we learn from the kind of way in which the national media has pretty much ignored that story. There have been bits and pieces of it here and there. But for a president who continues to take this, you know, hyper-militaristic approach to international relations and take a, you know, a foreign policy that has always been, at least in the post-World War II era, heavily reliant on American militarism, and to sort of take it even beyond that, for that kind of president to have that kind of record of military service and to have it virtually ignored by the dominant media, I think really tells us something about the devotion of the press to the powerful. And here, to pick up on something Bob said earlier, I think if Bill Clinton had had a similar record, we would have seen the sort of right-wing talk radio machinery, you know, feed on that for, you know, an indefinite period. I don't think Rush Limbaugh would have ever let go of that if it had been Bill Clinton and not George Bush. And that's about the particular power of right-wing talk radio, I think.
We're talking to Bob Jensen. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi. I want to take this in a little different direction. I mean, you're calling to task the media and essentially saying that there's a right-wing bias in large parts of it, and we can grant that, and the liberal bias. But I'd like to go in the other direction and say that the radical media also has its biases and refusal to really look at sacred cows. And I'll pick one in particular. I mean, Noam Chomsky is well known in Europe for his alliances in France with the neo-Nazis, and that's something that, though is well reported in European media, is completely overlooked or, what should I say, not mentioned in the American radical media. So I'd like to hang up and hear you talk about that and talk about the other sacred cows that the American radical media will not touch. Thank you.
Okay. Well, first of all, the sort of right-wing bias we're talking about, I wouldn't characterize it as right-wing or left-wing bias. I would say that what we see, you know, is an American news media that sort of moves with power. So when a kind of New Deal liberal regime was dominant in Washington, kind of Kennedy liberal types, well, the news media was pretty much in line with them, too. So I think it's more about who holds power at any given moment. And right now we just happen to be in a period of American history where really reactionary right-wing forces are dominant. So, you know, I don't want to pretend there's some, you know, only this right-wing conspiracy. You know, liberal-leaning administrations have understood how to control the press and use the routines of journalism to their advantage as well. As for whether or not the radical media have their own sacred cows, of course they do. I mean, there's no media system, no intellectual system that's, you know, free of its own biases and flaws. And I think the point is, in a healthy culture, in a healthy intellectual culture, and here I'm talking more broadly, not just about media, but the entire kind of intellectual culture, the schools, the universities, the book publishing industries, there would be a kind of a wide open, you know, robust debate, to borrow from the Supreme Court language. And that's the problem. That doesn't go on. And in such a situation, everybody would be sort of open for critique. On the Chomsky question, I disagree slightly with your interpretation. I don't think Chomsky runs with neo-Nazis and fascists. There's an incident in which he signed off on a what was essentially, I think, kind of a petition, which turned into a book forward, supporting, and Chomsky would, I think, argue this, supporting free speech, not supporting the conclusions of neo-Nazis. Chomsky is a very libertarian person on free speech issues. I would actually have disagreements with his interpretation of some of those things, but that's a position about free speech, not a position about neo-Nazis, and I think that charge has been aired in the U.S. I mean, I'm familiar with it. Everybody I know of who knows Chomsky's work is familiar with it. I've seen him being questioned about it in public talks, and he responds. So I do agree there are the problem of sacred cows is a problem of the human species, that we're not always the best at examining our own flaws. That's certainly true, and in a healthy intellectual culture, we'd all be kind of mixing it up on a regular basis. So slight disagreement about the Chomsky example, but in general, I think, you know, the claim can be made about any intellectual grouping and its problems in coming to terms with some things.
Yeah, I'm not sure which media in particular the caller was referring to, but I do know, for example, that within the past 5 years, both In These Times, the Chicago-based Newsweekly, and the Progressive magazine, the monthly based out of Madison, Wisconsin, both left liberal or progressive publications, certainly not considered mainstream, have actually run pieces quite critical of Noam Chomsky for what they thought was his position on the Pol Pot genocide in Cambodia, not being sufficiently critical of it. Mm-hmm. So he has not gotten kid gloves treatment on that particular issue by any stretch of the imagination, at least in those media. That's just a point of fact. Bob, we've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I'd like to take this time. My producer mentioned to me that you've been working on a new theory concerning the Kennedy assassination and 9/11. And that got my attention, and I was going to lead with that until Trent Lott did us the favor of extolling Senator Thurman. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, that was, of course, meant in jest.
Oh, darn it.
There's a serious point. This just came up. I was in Houston doing a talk. The kind of obsession with conspiracy theories that this country seems to produce, and in the case of 9/11, a lot of people on the left, and I consider myself a left progressive radical, you know, pick your term, I found it very disturbing that the degree to which some people were willing to sign on to conspiracy theories, that it was, you know, the U.S. government, that if they didn't actually do 9/11, they knew it was going to happen, it didn't stop it, or it was, you know, Mossad, or it was, there's all sorts of things that fly around out there. And I think it's important as a reminder that, you know, as leftists, we're already sort of behind the eight ball in this culture, right? Historically, powerful institutions have come after critical and left perspectives. And it's very important to make claims in public that one can support based on evidence. You know, it happened, I was giving a talk in Houston, and before the talk, I was talking to someone who floated one of these 9/11 conspiracy theories. And I said, well, do you have any evidence for that? He said, no, but I think it's true. and, you know, a lot of times we want to believe things, but I think if we're going to be effective in left political organizing, if we're going to go out as an anti-war movement and make arguments to the public, they really have to be grounded in evidence and sensible analysis. And I think, you know, a lot of us, and I understand the instinct, have become so skeptical of claims of the U.S. government, so aware of the constant lying and deception of agencies like the CIA and the FBI. I mean, it's, you know, history is littered with this kind of stuff. But just because they do that doesn't mean they do it every time. And just because that history is there doesn't mean they conspired to, you know, take down the World Trade Centers to provoke a war. And I think that tendency toward conspiracy theories, you know, there are conspiracies in history, and sometimes it's a way to understand things. But I think we have to be a lot more careful if we want to really build a movement that can you know, reach out to mainstream America.
And I think that the tendency towards conspiracy that you're talking about is encouraged by the fact that oftentimes there isn't really hard-hitting, detailed media analysis of what's going on, so people are left in this sort of cloud where there's anything goes. They can wing anything against the wall.
Right, and the, you know, the web has certainly made this this what I would call a problem much more difficult because, you know, you can stitch together, you know, a little evidence here, you know, a reasonable assertion there, and create conspiracy theories that at least on the surface seem very plausible. And there are, you know, no shortage of websites where all of this is out there. And, you know, this leads to another point, if we have time, which
sure.
is somebody said this to me yesterday, a young woman after my talk in Houston sat down and said, how do I know what's true? Where do, you know, how do I know what to read? The proliferation of information, you know, in all kinds of media, but especially on the web, has really left a lot of people just kind of almost, you know, punch drunk. Where do I go to understand the world? And you know, that comes back to the problem that to be a citizen in a democracy takes a lot of work, and it takes more work now than it's ever taken before, because you have to sort through, you have to understand. There's a lot. It's a complex world in which there's a lot of competing claims. And I think as a movement, one of the things we have to do is continually hold ourselves to the highest standards of evidence and analysis, and to put out information that we really can back up, because there's this problem out there of people not knowing what to believe, and if we don't keep our standards not only as high as the mainstream media, but I think they should be much higher, we should shoot for, you know, real accuracy in our work.
You're listening.
This is a serious problem.
You're listening to Bob Jensen, who's been my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bob, before we go, I'd like to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know how they can find out more about you and your work and your activities. Is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, there's. I work with a group here in Austin called the No War Collective, and we maintain a site at www.nowarcollective. That's all one word. NoWarCollective.com. And on that you'll find links to the pamphlet you mentioned earlier, to some of my own writing, to the writing of one of my colleagues here, Rahul Mahajan, who's got a very good book on the war on terrorism out, another book on Iraq coming, and links to other groups and other information.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob. I really want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been a real privilege, and let's stay in touch and have you back on the show in the coming months.
Would love to, and thanks to all the callers for the great questions.
All right. Great. Bye-bye, Bob.
Bye.
This is the band in the background tuning up, which means it's almost time for us to check out. Before we do, though, I'd like to just make a couple of announcements. First of all, if you'd like to get our weekly email update, remember, as I said earlier, all you need to do is send an email to our producer, Ben Scott, at dbscott@uiuc.edu, and give your name, and he'll get you hooked up. You'll get a weekly email that'll give you all the information you need to know about our guests, our coming guests, links to their material, like in the case of Bob Jensen, to his website and to his pamphlet that you can download for free. You'll only get one a week, and there will be absolutely no commercialism involved. You want to get off at any time, all you have to do is email us and tell us. Next week, we're going to be having as our guest Gene Kilbourne, the expert on gender and advertising, who we had in the studio to tape a show a few weeks ago when she was in town. And in 2 weeks, David Lindorf, talking about First Amendment rights, privileges, and civil liberties that are under attack today. So join us in the next 2 weeks. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and I'd like to thank my producer, Ben Scott, for his great work. See you next week.